The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close just in view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? 'Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
All right, folks, we've watched the think tanks of the military-industrial complex and the shadow government behind the American machine march all around the world on their quest to remain superpower supreme, but after years of staging coups, installing puppet regimes, and pillaging the resources of poorer peoples, nations are wising up to the same old game, and for better or worse, the world seems less predictable than it has in decades, maybe even centuries. Well, lucky for us, today's guest, F. William Ingdahl, is just the guy to help us unravel the tangled web that got us here and help us understand the landscape going forward in these troubled times. William is a strategic risk consultant, professor, and lecturer who holds a degree in politics from Princeton University and is the best-selling author of several great books, including Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, and Gods of Money, Wall Street, and the Death of the American Century, just to name a few. His latest is called The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, and it details the fizzling plans of the American shadow state and the history of the Middle East manipulation that paved the way. It's filled a lot of holes in my understanding of this complex saga. I don't know how he does it, but it's a real treat to have him here. William Ingdahl, welcome to The Higher Side.
Thank you, Greg. Good to be here with you.
Yeah, man, thanks for doing it. You've had such an impressive career, and you've tackled many pieces of the big puzzle, but tell us about The Lost Hegemon. Why this title and topic for your most recent book?
To come up with the right title where I felt the good energy took me almost a year. I had several working titles, but I wasn't satisfied with them. And finally, it hit. The Lost, of course, everybody knows a hegemon is the dominant power in a world political calculus. So the British Empire was the hegemon from the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, the Battle of Waterloo, until the First World War, more or less. And after 1945, America was the hegemon, the power that be. Mm-hmm. And they proclaimed it. Henry Luce, the chairman of Time Life magazine, in a famous essay in 1941 in Life magazine, called it the American century, the dawn of the American century. Now, 1941, the U.S. had not even militarily entered the war. That would take three more years. But they already, through the Rockefeller Foundation grants to Council on Foreign Relations, they had a secret project called the War and Peace Studies, where they were getting America's leading geopolitical minds from Johns Hopkins University, the president of Hopkins University, Isaiah Bowman, who was calling himself America's Haushofer. Haushofer was Adolf Hitler's geopolitician who worked out the Lebensraum strategy for moving to the east, taking Russia and everything in between. And they proclaimed the American century. And of course, that's what happened after 1945, the atomic bombs, Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That, by the way, was not aimed at the surrender of Japan. That was aimed at Stalin to tell him, we're the boss on the block. We are the hegemon. This is the American century and not some peace and harmony between two wartime allies, so-called. We're the boss here. So it was a little bit of a double cross on many sides. And the hegemon, the lost hegemon, is how I would describe the United States and its, I don't know whether to call them oligarchs or patriarchs, the David Rockefellers, the George Soroses, I don't want to dignify them by calling them an elite because they're beneath contempt as human beings, but they're an oligarchy of sorts. Let's call them that for a working title. And they are beginning to lose it everywhere. So that's the reason for the title, The Lost Hegemon. And if you look at the cover of the book, you can go on Amazon and just Google in The Lost Hegemon. And you'll see next to the title, by the way, is a graphic designer friend of mine did a beautiful concept on this. You can barely read it. It's gray on white, but faint gray on white because it's fading away. The power and the ability to control is disappearing from them. And next to it is a tattered flag, allegedly recovered from the rubble of the World Trade Twin Towers or Three Towers on September 11th, 2001. Let's say it was that flag, but it's a flag that's almost virtually destroyed. And that kind of describes the state of the United States of America as a world force for good or for anything, really, right now. And the book itself, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, documents the history since the 1950s of the perverse marriage between the American intelligence, especially the CIA, OSS during the war, but right after the war in Munich, Germany, the CIA, and something called the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look closely behind the surface of the so-called Arabic Spring, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, you will find that Hillary Clinton and Baden, her right-hand honcho, who is a Muslim Brotherhood woman, by the way, were trying to install Muslim Brotherhood regimes that the CIA controlled since the 50s in all of these key states, Tunisia, in Egypt. In Egypt, they actually got Mohamed Morsi, a brother, to be president for a few short months before the military kicked him out unceremoniously. But they were trying to do that all over the Middle East, because then they would be able to control all of the oil, all of the gas, all of the pipelines. But the lost hegemon is losing it everywhere. That's really the message of the book. So it's a unique, in my view, I've never seen a book that approached it in quite this way. It's a unique look at this completely hidden secret relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood. When Miles Copeland, the Cairo station chief of the CIA, by the way, he talked with me before his death as an investigative journalist about 20 years ago on some of this, but he brought them into Saudi Arabia and convinced the Wahhabite Bedouins that run that crazy country that the Muslim Brothers would be good, devout Sunni traditionalists who could help, you know, teach in the madrasas and in the universities and be the intellectuals and give these camel driver Bedouins, a little bit of gravitas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in fact, what they gave them, they took the Saudi money, the oil money, and built a network worldwide in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in the United States even, and so forth, of what today is Islamic terrorism. And Al-Qaeda came from that. Osama bin Laden was run into Afghanistan in the end of the 1970s, early 1980s, by the CIA, to recruit jihadists, psychopaths, to, in the name of Allah, murder and kill Russian communist soldiers in Afghanistan. So, and you can trace it right up into ISIS today, into Al-Qaeda in Syria called al-Nusra, which John Kerry and the Obama administration is supporting as the so-called moderate opposition to Assad. So that whole game has been blown up, but it's all about oil and gas pipeline control. So the lost hegemon, the interesting point about the book is they're losing it. They lost it on the Brexit Thursday night into Friday morning. Great Britain exited the European Union. The majority of the British population voted to leave this obscene construct called the European Union, which is no union at all. It's a top-down, anti-democratic control of the European oligarchs and the U.S. Very much in there. So that's, in short, that's the message of the book, but it's using the mask of religion to control world energy flows. And that's Dick Cheney's agenda right up until the present day, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a great book. I needed something like this, something that could unravel the history of the Muslim Brotherhood and its connection to the American Empire, because a lot of people talk about it, but not a lot of people, I think, know the details. You say in the book, a quote I liked is that it was a secret society that became known as the Society of the Muslim Brothers. That Muslim Brotherhood survived into the 21st century as the most powerful organized force in the Muslim world. Its origins were as revealing as they were alarming. And maybe you can elaborate on those origins in this context. Was it always from the beginning? Was this part of the plan, or was it something that formed later?
Well, British intelligence, MI6, back in the 1920s, when Hassan al-Banna, a modest school teacher from a village in Egypt, not exactly the kind of person you would imagine who would create an organization that is almost perfectly modeled on the military hierarchical structure of the Society of Jesus of the Jesuits and similar organizations, the SS in Nazi Germany, you wouldn't expect that he would have this kind of sophistication. So maybe he had a little help. Mm-hmm. But let's take the surface story. Hassan al-Banna in 1927-28 created a secret society in Egypt. They had shifting alliances. On one level, they were the good, devout, extra, you know, obedient, true Muslims. But the deeper side is they were a death cult. Al-Banna wrote in his special writings for all the members that to die in the name of Allah is the greatest good. You know, to kill in the name of Allah is the greatest good.
Mm-hmm.
So right away, you kind of get the idea they're into the death business big time, which they are and were. And it's, you know, you go our way or you take the highway. We're going to kill you.
Hmm.
And they were forced underground in Egypt in the 1950s when they tried to assassinate the president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser. And he didn't take to that too nicely. So they forced into the underground, and conveniently the CIA, Miles Copeland, whom I mentioned earlier, smuggled them into Saudi Arabia. And there began this perverse marriage, as I said before, between Wahhabism, fundamentalism from the 1700s of the deserts of Saudi Arabia, this pre-medieval, you can't get more backward than these camel herders of the Bedouins. And they married that with a militant, you know, evangelical Islam, political Islam, that had an agenda to take over and create a world caliphate. So it has, in the end, nothing to do really with religion or really with Quran or whatever. It has to do with power. And that's what the CIA found so fascinating. Even before the CIA got a hold of them, they were in exile during World War II in Berlin. Now, if people have any understanding of history, and I say that very carefully nowadays because in the schools of the United States, the subject of world history has been all but obliterated, and that's a very dangerous trend.
Mm-hmm.
But in World War II, in the 1940s and the 1930s, Germany was ruled by Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party, and the regime of terror was carried out by Heinrich Himmler and his SS, Stufenschutz, and they were Hitler's bodyguards, so-called, but they were the elite torturers and killers in the concentration camps and in all the occupied territories. And the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was a Muslim brotherhood, a close friend of Al-Banna. He came into exile from Egypt into Berlin, ran the Arab language broadcast of Radio Berlin, which was the most powerful radio transmitter in the world at that time, going right into the Middle East, preaching hate against the Jews. In fact, Himmler was a softy compared to the Mufti of Jerusalem in terms of Himmler wanted to make a deal to sell a certain portion of Jewish population from one of the Eastern European conquered countries. I think it was what used to be called Yugoslavia.
Hmm.
But he wanted to sell them and get some money for the Third Reich. And Al-Banna said, no, you must kill every last Jew.
Wow.
So this is the sweet side of the Muslim Brotherhood. And after the war, as I say, many of them had been fighting for Hitler against the communists in Eastern Europe and so forth. And they returned to Munich, Germany, and the CIA station chief at the time discovered this old Nazi network and the Nazis who used to run it, the East Abteilung, Ost Abteilung, and they began recruiting them for Radio Liberty broadcasts in the Muslim populations of the Soviet Union, which are quite vast. And, you know, that began this long, long-term relationship between the CIA and the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm. Yeah, it is fascinating, and the book does a great job of laying it all out. And this is essentially when you get up to 9/11, I mean, this Muslim Brotherhood, this alliance was very useful. And another important stop on this timeline is the onboarding of bin Laden in the 80s. Can you talk to us about that partnership?
Well, bin Laden was the scion or the descendant of one of the wealthiest construction families in Saudi Arabia. They built all the palaces for all the royals, and that's a lot of construction contracts if you know how the royals live in Saudi Arabia. And Osama bin Laden was recruited by the head of Saudi intelligence to go to Pakistan, not Afghanistan. Zia-ul-Haq was the dictator of Pakistan. He was a fanatical jihadist, Islamist, and a cutthroat killer of the first sort. You couldn't get more reactionary than him, but he was put in there with support of the U.S. State Department and CIA. And Osama bin Laden was sent to the border on the Pakistani side of Afghanistan to prepare a plan that was developed by Zbigniew Brzezinski when he was security advisor to Jimmy Carter in 1979. He said, if we do this right, we can induce the Soviets to militarily come in to stabilize Afghanistan, and that will give us the excuse to launch a major Vietnam against the Soviet Union, which is what happened, of course. It took 8 years, the biggest covert operation in CIA history. But finally, in 1988, Moscow threw up the white flag and said, we can't handle this anymore. The oil prices collapsed on the Western markets, and we can't support this war in Afghanistan anymore. Too many Russians have died. So the Osama bin Laden story is he was brought in to be the recruiter for Saudi intelligence and for U.S. intelligence of what would become the Mujahideen, the Holy Fighters. And Al-Qaeda was the name given to this organization. It means, in Arabic, the base. And the base was the database of all these recruits, many of them young Saudi psychopaths, many from Pakistan, many from all sorts of different Islamic countries. And they were sent in to Afghanistan to run terrorism against the Red Army.
Wow, man, you really break it down well. And, you know, I personally am always interested in what's going on outside of the Western machine and hearing about some of these other groups' angles in the big story. And when it comes to Western opposition, you write about the Shanghai Corporation Organization, which I doubt many listeners will be too familiar with. Can you elaborate on that alliance and their function a little bit?
Okay. This was created around 2001 by China and Russia mainly, to create some kind of structure once the Soviet Union dissolved all these Central Asian former parts of the Soviet Union, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, all the stands. They were being targeted by the CIA and the Muslim Brotherhood for the CIA, and they were all heavily Islamic regions of the Soviet Union, so they were very vulnerable to this same template. And they worked, because some of these are Turkic Islamic cultures, they worked through an organization that the CIA created and controlled up until the present called the Fethullah Gulen Organization out of Turkey. And someone documented that there were no less than 500 CIA agents across Central Asia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and so forth, in the early 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union, masquerading in schools of Fethullah Gulen, madrasas and schools of Gulen, as native-speaking English teachers. So Russia caught on to this because the CIA was bringing these Mujahideen over through Air America flights into Azerbaijan, where they wanted to control the oil for British Petroleum and ARCO, and then on into Chechnya, where a Russian pipeline would have brought the Baku oil into the world market through Russia. That was an old existing pipeline. And the U.S. would have none of that. They wanted to control the oil of the former Soviet Union. So they brought in the Mujahideen into Chechnya and created an unholy mess there, jihad. And under Yeltsin, the response was chaotic. Under Vladimir Putin, toward the end of the 90s, it was settled rather brutally and rather quickly, but that was an American Muslim Brotherhood attempt to destabilize what was left of Russia and just break them into pieces. Fortunately for the world today, it didn't succeed.
Hmm. Man, you're great at giving us the hidden context to world events. And now, because the Clinton dynasty never seems to really go away, and they might be getting another run at the White House, how did we see the Muslim Brotherhood relationship used during the Clinton years? Should we expect more trouble in another Clinton presidency?
Oh, God forbid that Hillary Clinton ever steps foot in the White House again. God forbid, and I mean that with respect. This person, or it's not a woman or a man, it's an it. She, really, I can't stress this enough. Her career with Bill Clinton, when he was Attorney General and Governor of Arkansas, covering up for CIA cocaine money flows from Colombia through the main Arkansas airport and getting piles of $100 bills as payoff for that.
Right.
She was involved in covering up for murders that she and Bill arranged through the organized crime mafia to eliminate people who were about ready to uncover that in Arkansas politics. And then Bill Clinton gets into the State House and into the White House in the early 90s as a front for George Bush Sr. Because Bill Clinton, the hidden story there is that Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr. were intimately close. Clinton was probably recruited by the CIA through the networks of Bush Sr. And Bush had lost the confidence of the American people after the Iraq War of 1991 against Saddam Hussein. The economy was in trouble. So you remember the famous quote from Bill Clinton on the presidential debate, "It's the economy, stupid."
Right.
But that was all stage-oriented, or organized. It was all stage. And the idea was that Bill Clinton, Bubba, you know, this kind of good old boy from Arkansas with the SEG smile, would hold the post. Bush, baby Bush, could come in and replace him 8 years later, which is what happened. So now we have this obscenity called Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump presumably will be the Republican candidate. So you'll have a choice between not the lesser of two evils, but evil one or evil two. Which one do you want? They're both going to kill you.
Yeah, I know. It's a rough situation. And I've heard you talk about Trump a little bit, because a lot of people, I think it's kind of a simplistic, naive kind of position, but they think that Trump is the dark horse who's really disrupting the apple cart in the political system. And I think that's naive. And I've heard you talk about his background and his mafia connections a little bit. Tell us about why we might not want to be so quick to jump on the Trump train.
Well, Trump is a master of articulating rage that many Americans feel at Washington, at their own life situation, at the fact the economy is in the dregs since 2008, 2007. So there's a lot of rage there. And Trump is very good at pushing that up out onto the table in a politically incorrect way.
True.
He's a demagogue, a classical demagogue like Benito Mussolini or Adolf Hitler, if you study the speeches in a clinical way, really. Mm-hmm. And all he does is give sound bites. He gives little one-liners. He's got prompters who prep him on one-liners. And it seems like he's radical, but in fact, he changes his positions depending on the organization that he stands in front of,
right?
Something Hillary Clinton is starting to use against him. But that doesn't mean Hillary is good and he's bad. Trump got his start in the construction business. Now, if you know anything about New York City construction, organized crime, the Gambino family, all of these, and construction go hand in glove in New York City. And that hasn't changed from the 30s and the 40s right up into the present. So that's where Trump Towers and all this stuff came from. Then Donald Trump gets in as Mr. Clean, because he's not known in the casino gambling circuits, and opens up casino gambling in Atlantic City in the early 80s. Now, casino gambling is organized crime, pure, unadulterated. Las Vegas, Macau, Atlantic City, it's all money laundering for organized crime.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't come in there as a Mr. Clean amateur and do what Trump did in Atlantic City. He made the deals with the right people. Every serious business associate Donald Trump has had up until his presidential bid had links to one or another mafia organized crime organization. And his mentor, when he was starting in business after he left the business school in his early 20s, his mentor in the 1960s was a guy named Roy Cohn, C-O-H-N. Now, Roy Cohn was a mobster lawyer who used to have the Gambino family make their mafia meetings where they cut deals in his law offices so that the FBI or the police couldn't touch them because this was lawyer-client privilege. And Donald Trump used to go to a place, I don't know if anybody remembers this anymore, but when I was working as a journalist in New York City in the 70s, late 70s, there was a notorious place, a crack cocaine disco called Studio 54. And Roy Cohn used to bring Donald Trump there regularly. They were both regulars. And, you know, this was the shikimiki hoi polloi of New York politics, names that shouldn't appear in the daily news. And mostly they didn't because they paid the right people. And they would have cocaine orgies, and Donald Trump even described it in one of his autobiographies. You know, he said, I saw a scene. This is the man who wants to be president, the moral leader of the United States of America. Said, I was standing there watching this with seven of the most dazzling models I've ever seen in my life, lying on chairs in the middle of Studio 54, getting screwed by seven men at the same time.
Wow.
You know, this is kind of the moral fiber of the man. So if you want someone like that as president, it's your bed and you're going to make it. But I think we ought to take a lesson from the British, what they did last Thursday, and just take responsibility for our nation back.
Mm-hmm. And obviously this Brexit thing is big news. I hear a lot of people I respect coming down on both sides. But ultimately, I think any kind of decentralization is a good thing in the long run. But, of course, here with Trump and Clinton, yeah, it seems like just another false choice as always. But another thing I wanted to mention while we're talking about Clinton is that I've talked to researchers who have gone over the Clinton death list, the many suspicious deaths that seem to surround the Clintons.
Yeah.
You know, an alarming number of people who are their opposition or have dirt on them end up dying. And there is a new one. This UN diplomat, John Ash, he crushed his own throat in a workout accident, apparently, just as he was starting to talk to investigators on this Clinton international bribery thing. And it doesn't surprise me, but when we have these two choices, if there's any real difference at all because of these deaths and Hillary's warmongering career, it seems like she's the more dangerous to me, but I'm not going to be happy either way.
Yeah, they're both pretty undesirable. We're coming into a kind of a new paradigm, I think, in the world. And this may sound a little bit strange to some because we're used to the old familiar. But all these, it's the lost hegemon theme. All these scenarios, all these manipulations of the population, like we're a bunch of stupid sheep, they're not working anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They can't, 5 years on in Syria, this tiny little country, the CIA, the MI6 of Britain, the French intelligence, the U.S. Pentagon, all of this can't get rid of Bashar al-Assad to build that gas pipeline into the European Union that Qatar wants to build on behalf of the United States. They can't do it. It's not working, and none of these scenarios are working. Look at what they did in Libya. That was Hillary Clinton's operation.
Right.
To demonize the man who had created the most prosperous standard of living of any nation in Africa and the Middle East called Libya. The literacy rate under Gaddafi had almost completely disappeared. It was under 10%. Before that, it was almost 90% illiteracy under the king. And the country had been given a share of the oil wealth because Gaddafi was an intelligent tribal leader. He said, we have to have peace among the tribes so that everybody feels they're included and they're cared for. So he did not privatize his state oil company, much to the anger of the Italians and the French and the British, who wanted to grab that oil. It's beautiful oil in terms of quality. So he took that oil and created kind of a sovereign wealth fund and reinvested that in the future of Libya. He was building this huge freshwater pipeline to irrigate the desert. He was giving down payment on homes to any couple that was newly married. Education was free. Medical care was free. There was no war in Libya for the entire time of Gaddafi, but Hillary Clinton didn't like that because Gaddafi was about to do something that Hillary's advisors said this would not be good for the dollar.
Right.
Gaddafi and the president of Tunisia, a neighbor of Libya, named Ben Ali, and the president of Egypt named Mubarak were about to create a unified currency region with a gold-backed dinar. Gaddafi had the gold from his oil sales, and he was going to sell the oil of Libya only for gold dinars. So no dollars. If you want our oil, Germany or England or whoever, you have to come up with gold and buy some of our dinars. Mm-hmm. So that was a direct threat against the sovereignty or the hegemony of the U.S. dollar as a way to control the world economy. And it has nothing to do with nationalism. These oligarchs are not nationalists. They're globalists. Right. David Rockefeller and Soros and this bunch of malcontents. They want to use the dollar to control the world, quite simply. And if the countries like Libya started a gold-backed dinar system with Egypt and Tunisia, that would spread across the oil world of the Middle East. And China and Russia already are well on their way toward gold-backed ruble, gold-backed yuan, renminbi in China. And they've been buying gold for years to build that up and build it up as a credible alternative to the bankrupt de facto U.S. dollar, where the public debt on that dollar system is more than 100% of GDP. And that has happened since George W. Bush became president. It's doubled.
And I'm so glad you broke down Libya because it's so polar opposite from the story we're told. And it does seem like Gaddafi's just another casualty on the quest to escape international banker control, which is a sad thing. But I've heard you talk about the Bushes and the Clintons working for the same faction. I totally agree with you there. But did we see much of a gameplay change or a shift in alliances under Obama, or have we pretty much stayed the course?
No, it's change. The only thing that changed was the skin color of the man in the White House. And that's not a racist remark. That's just the only thing that changed.
Right.
And Obama appointed every single key economic position were from Wall Street to Geithner, who came from the New York Federal Reserve. You had all the key positions were named by Robert Rubin, the former chairman of Goldman Sachs, who became the vice chairman of Citigroup. And he was on the transition team, Robert Rubin. So the Wall Street banks control the financial side of the Obama administration. The Nobel Peace Prize winner, Barack Obama, who was given the prize before he even got his shoes off in the Oval Office, was given to the man who bought into Petraeus's 30,000 surge into Afghanistan, this brilliant strategy that has worked so catastrophically. So the military-industrial complex pretty much has run him along with big oil. Now, there was an interesting period where Chuck Hagel was Secretary of Defense. Dempsey was Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This was early in the Syria war. And I believe genuinely they tried to stop the president going berserk in a bombing campaign in Syria like what he did in Libya under the advice of Hillary Clinton. Obama's a spineless president, is not my assessment. It's pretty much the universal assessment. And when certain people are forceful, he said, okay, you do it. And he gave the portfolio to Hillary Clinton, to Samantha Power, to Susan Rice, this trio who said, we have a responsibility to protect innocent civilians in Syria. That's a George Soros concept, which is legal nonsense, but it sounds good on a soundbite. And they used that to bomb Libya into the Stone Age. And then the plan was to roll that war and even the jihadists who were armed by the CIA from Libya into Syria to do the same thing within a matter of a few months in Syria. It didn't work. Mm-hmm. So this is the main thing. It's the good news is these characters are losing it everywhere. The bad news is they're getting desperate and trying crazy things. But I think in the end, we're winning and they're losing. Mm-hmm. I mean, decent human beings who want to peaceful life for their family and friends and their country.
Right. I've tried to be optimistic too. It does seem like a certain tide is changing. But the reason I bring up a shift in alliances, or the reason I ask you about that, is because sometimes this stuff gets pretty confusing to me. We, of course, have public alliances, private alliances, a lot of stuff going on when you try to unpack it all. But to quote your book, and I believe you were talking about things that happened in the Obama administration. But you say Israel and Saudi Arabia were deeply alarmed by the U.S. shift to back the political Islam of the Muslim Brothers, to put it mildly. The self-confident Israelis of the 1990s seemed now confused, lacking a clear strategy, fearful and aggressive in an increasingly futile manner. Can you elaborate maybe on what you're referring to there?
Well, if you look at the relations between the Obama administration and Netanyahu, the Likud, in Israel, since Obama made clear he was going for the nuclear deal with Iran, he was doing that not for good reasons, but to play Iran in a way to advance this military control by the U.S. of the entire oil resources in the Middle East, you know, to create a destabilization of Saudi and so forth. But Netanyahu looked on this not in a very friendly way, and the problem is Israel as a functioning nation has no clear strategy at this point under Netanyahu. He has so many coalition partners in these lunatic religious cults and so forth, fundamentalists, the settlers and others. But now Putin, who's a political animal of the first order, and I mean that in a good sense, he's got a nose to smell out when there's an opening. He recently met with Netanyahu and made a proposal. We, Russia, we're in Syria, and we have a pretty strong presence there with Bashar al-Assad. You have a huge natural gas offshore field, a huge one called Leviathan. You haven't yet been able to develop it in partnership with this American Noble Energy from Texas. We, Gazprom, I will get them to be a capital investor in Leviathan, so you have enough money to bring this gas online. And furthermore, we will give you security that the Iranian and the Hezbollah, who otherwise are rather not in a love romance with Israel, will not sabotage your gas fields in Leviathan, because they will not mess with Russia. How that's going to play out, I don't know. I was in St. Petersburg Economic Forum giving a talk a week and a half ago, and after my remarks, an Israeli ambassador came up to me, and her job was to work through this new Russian-Israel rapprochement, or whatever you want to call it. There are a million Russian Jews living in Israel since the end of the Soviet Union, so Putin has a little bit of influence there politically. The world is changing. The alliances are changing. Israel has done criminal things. Russia has done criminal things. Every country you can name has done criminal things. China too. But things are changing, and the constellations are forcing a new tectonic shift, if you will. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it so fascinating. I'm not at all pessimistic about where we're headed.
Yeah, it's hard to go downhill, so change is good. And to put a finer point on the saga you lay out in the book and the ambitious post-9/11 plan that seems to be losing steam now, The notion that the U.S. wanted better control over the Middle Eastern oil supply is well established at this point, but you take that further, and I wanted to read another great quote. You say, "On a deeper level, these actions were part of a larger global strategy to defeat the only effective resistance to the creation of a new 21st century universal fascism, a return to the dark times of the Middle Ages, but on a world scale. One world that would be controlled by very rich Western families whose agenda was total control over the world and reduction of the global population through eugenics, wars, and terrorism." I mean, that's it, man. That's the big conspiracy in a nutshell, isn't it?
That's pretty much it, yeah. The Rockefeller family have been financing the American eugenics movement and the world eugenics movement since the 1920s through the Rockefeller Foundation. Eugenics was what the Nazis worked on with Joseph Mengele and the Nazi doctors in Auschwitz and so forth. That's well documented. That's no speculation.
Right.
And what's not so well documented is what I document another book of mine, The Seeds of Destruction, Genetic Manipulation, that genetic manipulation is a spinoff of eugenics. And the Rockefeller Foundation from 1926 until 1939, when rather the Nazis invaded Poland and World War II was officially begun by the British, they financed all of the eugenics research of the Nazis at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin and in Munich and elsewhere. And after the war, they made sure that the best of the Nazi doctors, these brain experimenters and so forth, were smuggled into Canada and the United States, given new identities, respectability, and continued their work for the Rockefellers. Eugenics is population reduction of the lesser breed, you know, the inferiors, and cloning or whatever. This is what genetic manipulation is all about, to try to clone human beings and breed, you know, the master race. That's the Nazi thing, but it's also the Rockefeller thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that book was the first one of yours that I had learned about, and I know it came out a couple of years ago, but how have you seen things advancing on the GMO front? What stage are we in with the Monsanto GMO agenda? Has anything changed recently?
Oh, very much has changed recently, especially. Monsanto has become so discredited as a brand in the world. You mention the name Monsanto, and every person on the street of Europe, their hackles go up. They think this is the worst, most evil company ever made. Mm-hmm. And they're not far wrong. It's a Rockefeller company, by the way. Since World War I, they were a chemical company like Hercules Powder and DuPont and Dow Chemical that made chemicals for the pursuit of World War I against Germany on behalf of the British and the French, and then in World War II. And then they rechanged their image to be a so-called biotech company, but the essence of it are the chemicals, the agrochemical weed killers, Roundup, of most widely used weed killer in the world. It's used by housewives and people in their family gardens. It's used in public parks, and it's the WHO last year announced that it's a probable carcinogen, which means a cancer-causing substance because of glyphosate, the main chemical used in Roundup. So this is a death operation, the whole GMO experiment. What recently happened, and I finished an article, it's on my website, williamengdahl.com, if anyone wants to look it up in the next few days when it's posted. The Russian Duma, the Parliament of Russia, on a third reading, has finally passed a complete ban on all GMO cultivation in the Russian Federation, the biggest land area on this planet. And Putin, in December of last year, President Putin said, "We want to make Russia into the world's leading exporter of pure, clean, organic food to the world that's being contaminated with this GMO junk." And I'm sure it was Monsanto, but the GMO cartel probably bought off a couple of Russian scientists at the Academy of Science and ran one of the flimsiest studies to claim that GMO has no problem, it's all good for us, and so forth. And the president of the Academy of Sciences in January got a meeting with Vladimir Putin to tell him GMO is good, it's good for Russia, we should get into it. Well, God bless his soul, Vladimir held firm and did not flinch a bit on this nonsense. Russian scientists ripped this report to shreds, and on Friday. I call it Black Friday in the article because for the oligarchs, Friday, the 24th of June, will go down in their history books, if they are around to write the history books, as Black Friday Mega, because it was the day that the British people voted to leave this totalitarian construct called the European Union in Brussels. First time, nobody could imagine this would happen. And on that same day, the Russian parliament voted the law to ban all GMO. And a few months earlier, the Russian Food Safety Authority banned all soybeans and all corn imports into the Russian Federation from the United States because it contained traces of GMO, if it wasn't GMO, or it contained other toxins. So this is a huge defeat for Monsanto. The European Union is now debating, and this is unprecedented. I've lived in Germany, I've lived in Europe for 30 years as a researcher, as an economist, as a teacher and lecturer. And I've followed agribusiness, agriculture, because it's a key part of the agenda of the U.S. oligarchs. Control food, you control people, control oil, you control nations, control money, as Henry Kissinger said in the 1970s, and you control the entire world. So food, that's the initial reason that I got interested in this agribusiness, the Cargill, Archer Daniel Midland, these big grain cartel companies. And then Monsanto folded into that quite logically in the early part of this century. So now Monsanto is so disgraced that they allowed themselves to be taken over by one of the old Nazi chemical companies called Bayer AG in Germany. And Bayer AG has the public image of little aspirin producers, aspirins, Bayer aspirin. And in fact, they produce some of the most deadly agriculture chemicals that are responsible for the death of bee colony. We call it bee colony disorder, but it's just poisoning of the bees. 4 or 5 years ago, such that the European Union was forced to ban these neonicotinoids, that they're called, these nerve-killing chemicals that were being sprayed to kill pests in the agriculture. And Bayer is the old IG Farben, the cartel that ran the gas ovens. Bayer is the company whose scientists originally in the 1880s synthesized and gave the name heroin to a form of opium that was sold then by Bayer as children's cough medicine. Believe me or not, this is all documented. So there's huge changes going on in these companies because they're in trouble. They're trying to come up with new covers, so it'll be called Bayer and the name Monsanto will disappear and people will forget. They count on us being stupid, really stupid.
Right. So, I mean, this is all so interesting. And right now, I think people are a little hung up on using the label World War III. There's obviously a lot of pressure around the world. Things are changing, as we've been talking about. And when it comes to the current climate, we know that banker manipulations are pretty much behind everything in global markets. And we have the price of oil being so low. Is this a manipulation as well? I've heard you talk about this, and it seems like you've predicted, or perhaps you're thinking, that this could be preparation for some type of big event, as we've seen before.
I considered that possibility about 7-8 months ago, and it looked like it was heading toward really a World War III. At this point, I don't see a world war coming. I see a Pentagon desperate to come up with reasons to convince Congress to up the Pentagon budget in the next budget round and the next several budget rounds at a time when the federal budget has to be drastically reduced or the country is going to go off the skids in terms of debt and insolvency. So they're making this boogeyman out of Clinton. They tried to make the boogeyman out of ISIS, but it wasn't big enough to get those Pentagon, high-tech arms things like the silly F-35 all-purpose, all-service fighter jet and things like that, all this pork barrel stuff that the Pentagon loves so much. So they're using the fact that Russia intervened in Syria, which came as a surprise, and they did so with a shoestring military budget, and by comparison with the Pentagon, in more or less in the Russians' backyard, they managed to put together certain missile systems, cruise missile systems that were fired from the Black Sea with precision on targets in Syria. Now, that's awesome. Their jets, no jet in the world's air forces can burn a candle next to some of these Russian machines and the targeting and precision. So what the Pentagon is trying to do is a bunch of neocon military types who want a fat retirement job working for the military-industrial complex, like Breedlove. I think he's angling for a post as defense secretary under President Hillary, the former commander of NATO Europe, who are yelling and screaming about how Russia is the biggest threat to world peace and so forth. And then you have retired generals in a position to know, saying everybody privately in the U.S. and European military knows that there is no aggressive threat from Russia on any European country. They have no desire for another war. They lost 27 million people in World War II, winning the war for the Americans, as the Russians put it, because that's who took credit. They don't even acknowledge what sacrifice the Russians made. Mm-hmm. So Russia doesn't want war. I've been to Russia so many times in the last 20 years, I can tell you, they do not want war. They do not want hostility with the United States. They would love to be at peace with America. Young Russians, they soak up American music, American pop culture. You go to restaurants in Moscow or St. Petersburg, where I was a week ago for this forum, and you know, you'd think you were in New York City or something. It's just totally Western, but they're very proud people. And this is something the neocons in Washington have no culture. They're a bunch of barbarian apes, and they can't understand culture and history, that the Russians are a very proud people, and they're not about to have their head pushed into the toilet bowl by a bunch of unwashed neocons like Ash Carter and Victoria Nuland, who is the Assistant Secretary for Russia and Eastern Europe under John Kerry.
Well, you know, for years, the American machine has run on perpetual war, and any time our economy takes a downturn, war is ramped up, and they kind of gloss over that downturn. If the world is wising up to our game and not as quick to get into conflicts as the United States government might want, should we expect our economy to take a hit as well and follow suit with the kind of the flushing out of that plan?
Greg, you are doing this interview from California, you said.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me, but what state is the United States' real economy in since the financial crisis of 2008? My view is it's in a Great Depression worse than the 1930s, but Washington lies about the unemployment. It's in actuality, according to a good friend of mine who tracks these economic data, John Williams and shadow government statistics, its real unemployment is 22.7%, somewhere in that range. That's 1930s level.
Mm-hmm.
The jobs have all been outmigrated to Asia, to South America, Mexico, whatever, the factory jobs, the solid, you know, real economy jobs. We have a $3 trillion, the last estimate by the Society of Construction Engineers that I read, is a $3 trillion national infrastructure deficit of rail lines, bridges, highway bridges, sewer works, waterways, electricity grids that urgently needs renewal. But we spend it on bailing out these brain-dead banks of Wall Street. So we're in the crisis.
Yeah.
We're in the crisis. That's why I call it the lost hegemon in my new book, because they really kind of have lost it. You know, David Rockefeller, you look at pictures of this gruesome character.
Yes.
You know, he's got eyes that are oozing blood. He's had supposedly his sixth human heart transplant. Lord knows where the hearts come from. And, you know, he's close to 100.
Yeah, a lot of those guys are.
Yeah, and Soros looks the same. He looks like in the last year or two, he's aged 100 years. So, you know, these are the guys that we're supposed to look up to as powerful, influential people. Give me a break.
Right.
They've been around too long for any good that they've done, which they've never done. So let's take the country, not like Donald Trump says, take it back. Let's really be responsible for the country with the most beautiful constitution of any country in world history, the American Constitution. Well, that's was destroyed, ripped up by Bubba Bush in 2001 with the Patriot Act and all these other things. We can take that back. Let's roll back the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which created the control of sovereign money of the United States of America in the hands of private Wall Street banks.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the Federal Reserve Act. Mm-hmm. And let's put that back into the responsibility of Congress to create credit for the good of the nation. And if Congress doesn't do that, we vote them out. You can't vote out the governor of the Federal Reserve. It's appointed, you know, by Wall Street, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So a few simple things and we could work miracles. But some people really want to destroy anything positive about our country. And I think it's time we said, like what the British people said last Friday, enough is enough. We're fed up with your top-down pushing around.
Amen. I try to be optimistic, you know, but knowing how calculated the oligarchs are and how they have their strings on pretty much everything, playing the puppet master role, can we really trust the integrity of that Brexit vote, you think? Would they leave that up to chance, or could this possibly be something that they wanted? I mean, the vote was so close. I think 2%.
No, I've had this discussion with serious friends of mine. It really caught them with their pants down. It caught them by surprise. They thought 2 days before the vote, they had it nailed. They had fake polls coming out saying the Stay faction had the majority and da-da-da-da-da. Cameron was threatening financial ruin for the average Brit if they did this. I think what tipped it first of all, you have to understand the British frame of mind. They're also a very proud people like the Russians,
mm-hmm.
and a very independent people. British history, you go back to Henry VIII and the Protestant and the whole cultural thing and the wars. And they have this island mentality. We're not part of continental mainland Europe. We're British. We're something special. And that has a good side and a bad side. But in this case, they looked at Europe with Angela Merkel opening her arms to more than 1 million political refugees, calling them migrants and beautiful people, and they're going to boost the German economy, and all they're doing is boosting the German debt. But 130,000 of the 1 million disappeared, and these were young males between 18 and 26. They disappeared. The police, nobody in Germany, one of the most documented controlled countries in Europe, they don't know where these guys are. They could be Al-Qaeda, they could be ISIS. Obviously, many of them are, and they're in sleeper cells all around Germany, all around Europe as a result. So not that every person who came across on the boat is an ISIS, far from it, but the British look at Europe and see how crazy they've become. And they say, we don't want this. We want to keep a British identity. We've had it for more than 1,000 years, and by God, we're going to keep it. And the laws that Brussels makes are not laws that we consider good for English people, and it's getting worse, not better. We're going to exit. And that's what they did. And all the manipulation, all the terror campaigns, everything you can imagine, even this member of parliament on the Conservative Party who was murdered. She wasn't a political murderer, I don't think. She was murdered a few days before the vote. And they took the murder and gave it a spin that it was a pro-exit killer who killed her because she was wanting to stay inside the EU. So that seemed to tilt things for a day or so. But then the British people said, no. I remember talking to a British woman, retired. Her husband was for staying in the European Union. And she said, no, I think we need to get out. It's a rotten system. It's top down. We have no control over what happens to our country anymore under Brussels. And when Obama, President of the United States, comes to England and tells us we better stay in the European Union, that got my hackles up. I don't like any foreign president meddling in British affairs. So that convinced me that getting out of this thing was the right thing.
Mm-hmm. And I also know you've spent a decent amount of time in China, sweatshop of the world. And you also wrote a book called Targeting China.
Yeah.
How do you see this global conflict from their perspective?
China is a complicated country. It's in many respects a beautiful country. The people have unbelievable energy to build the future. I was invited by one of the translators of one of my books, The Seeds of Destruction, to give a lecture in Kunming, China. Before I went there, I knew very little about Kunming. I knew only that it was, by looking at Google Maps, that it was close to the border of Laos. So it's, you know, it's pretty far on the into the interior. And I come to Kunming, and there's a city of 13 or 12 million people with skyscrapers. It looks as modern as Frankfurt or Berlin nowadays. And, you know, what they've built in 34 years is just astonishing. And now they have this project called the One Belt, One Road, the new economic Silk Road, high-speed railway and crucial strategic port systems, oceanways for the trade. And that is transforming the economic map of Eurasia from Russia is part of this. Putin has just finished a tour in China with President Xi, talking about exactly these projects. So you have Russia and China economically weaving the web of cooperation and peaceful cooperation, very different from the Soviet-Stalin-Mao relationship. And they both realize that the agenda of Washington is to destroy any kind of autonomy that either country has. The only chance they have to come out of this and create a counterpole of stability is to work together. The Russian military exceeds anything the Chinese have. We saw this in Syria, but even before that, their anti-missile defense systems, the S-400 and so forth, the Chinese are buying that because it's the most cutting-edge anti-missile system in the world, light years beyond anything the U.S. has with Raytheon and so. So China needs, in a sense, Russia. And Russia needs China. Russia needs the Chinese financial support for infrastructure projects to build these rail lines that are crisscrossing Eurasia. And it's kind of a synergy that fits very beautifully. And it's changing the map of Eurasia, and that's going to change the map of the world in the next 10 to 15 years, in my view.
It's amazing what groups of people can do when they want to work together. I'd like to see high-speed rail all around the world, but it's just not the priority for the oligarchs. It'll be an interesting decade and a half, for sure. Now, this is a bit of a gear switch, but I also wanted to ask you about the Jesuits. We've talked about them here before as the intelligence agents of the Vatican. They come up in the book when you discuss the 30 Years' War, but I've heard people talking about their more recent agendas, and I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the Jesuit order?
It's remarkable that since the order was officially created in Spain under Ignatius Loyola and Francis Xavier in the 1540s as a military order that fought a counter-reformation against the Protestant movement on behalf of the Vatican and to retake large parts of Europe for the Vatican, that the first pope in the history of that organization to be a Jesuit is Francis. Now, I was in Slovenia, and my publisher in Slovenia told me an interesting story. Everybody thinks that this Pope Francis models himself as a humble, down-to-earth pope based on St. Francis of Assisi, the one who was a nature lover and, you know, washed the feet of the poor and all these things. And this is all Jesuit PR. It's all a sham. The name Francis, as was posted on the website of the Society of Jesus in the first minutes after he announced his name as Pope, it came from Francis Xavier, the co-founder of the Society of Jesus in the 1540s. And then when they realized that the world press speculated that it was Francis Assisi, because not too many of them were familiar with Xavier, he said, this is how we'll play it. So the Jesuits have been described as the Vatican assassins. They have been kicked out of many countries. Even popes have kicked them out of Rome in the past. They have a corner on education in the church. They're a secret society. They're a militaristic society. The head of the Jesuit order is called Director General, I believe, but anyway, the general. And it's a military organization, top down. And they're up to no good. The refugee crisis in Europe, this Pope is going around telling Europeans, there'd be no crisis. This is a migration. He uses the word migration, and that's a very different word from political refugees seeking asylum.
Right.
Because their life is in danger. Migration is, you have migrations of antelope and bird migrations and human migrations coming from Germany and Sweden to find work in the United States. And they had immigration quotas from the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So many 10,000 Italians, so many 10,000 per year Swedes and so forth. And that was all orderly and managed. And if you were over the quota, you had to wait. Well, that's a migration. That's an orderly process. This is no migration. This is a war created by Washington largely and the Vatican. I have it on good account from someone who claims to have inside information that the former general of the Jesuits is in Syria running the whole Syrian side of this destabilization, Kolvenbach. The Dutch, who's a specialist in Syrian culture and history. So I think from the side of the Vatican and the Jesuit order, and Opus Dei is involved in this as well. This, if you saw the Da Vinci Code, that was based in part on the history of Opus Dei, this criminal band of fanatical members of this Catholic order that originated also out of Spain, like the Jesuits. So it has nothing to do, in my view, with religion. It has to do with control of human beings. And like they did during the 30 Years' War and the Counter-Reformation, their job is to bring people back into the Dark Ages in Europe. So they're using the refugees, I think, this is my view, otherwise it doesn't make sense. They're using the refugees, these war refugees, these traumatized people, to completely destabilize Europe and break down the borders, you know, so there's no national culture, no sense of Belgian is this, that, and the other thing, and we're proud of this, that, and the other in our history, or a Dutch, or a German, despite Hitler and so forth. They have some beautiful history with Beethoven, Bach, and art, and Renaissance, and so forth. Every nation has that. Italy, Leonardo, Da Vinci. So that's going to be destroyed, and people are going to be driven into states of fear to seek refuge in a false religion. And it'd be kind of a, I think what Francis is aiming for is a one-world religion, a synthetic religion, like the Rockefellers have talked about for years, where everybody can be controlled by this religious ideology, you know, like sheep.
Right. Yeah, and it's such a strange faction that we don't hear nearly enough about, but I've always heard that the shadow government of the Vatican is led by the Black Pope, who's always been a Jesuit, but now the public-facing Pope is a Jesuit. I mean...
the Black Pope is the White Pope.
Right. It just seems odd. I mean, I know that they do things in a very calculated manner. Do you find that significant at all?
Very.
Right.
Very. You know, the Jesuits, look up in the Oxford English Dictionary, the word Jesuitical. It's in the common language for centuries. And for good reason, it means someone who's sly, cunning, deceiving in his use of words. And that's the Jesuits. You know, they kill popes if the pope singing on the same sheet of music.
Huh.
This pederasty scandal, look carefully at the record of Francis on the pederasty. Look at his record when he was cardinal in Argentina. He protected the military dictatorship, the junta, who was put in there by Henry Kissinger in the 80s and David Rockefeller. He protected them and turned over Catholic priests to the military junta for torture because he wanted to be on their good side. So that tells you what a man of God he is.
Huh. Dark stuff indeed. it's just, it's an odd position to be in as a somewhat enlightened American, because we all see the terrible things the power elite have done around the globe in our name, and to see their plans deteriorate, it is encouraging, but I can't help but feel a little concerned that my fate might be a bit linked to that of the nefarious elite. And you're a guy who grew up in the States, you now live in Germany. Do you have any special advice for Americans preparing for the decline of the American empire?
Celebrate it. America is not an imperial country. Why should we control other nations?
Right.
Why should we control any other nation? America has so many things it needs to take care of in their own backyard. We have, as I mentioned earlier, $3 trillion of infrastructure deficit. Let's get the Federal Reserve out of business and put it into the hands of the Congress, as the Constitution mandated, and nationalize those six or seven bankrupt banks, these brain-dead banks of Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase. They're all criminal enterprises. If we did like Iceland did after their banking crisis, the heads, the CEOs, and the boards of directors would all be sitting in prison right now. Instead, they're given bonuses. They're bigger than ever. What kind of a crazy nation have we become? We let them lead us around like dogs by the nose, but they're more of us than they are of these characters.
Right.
So, you know, just wake up. Wake up and do what comes naturally. Defend your rights, not with guns necessarily, but defend them with your actions, with your votes, with the don't vote for Hillary, don't vote for Trump. Find, some way to express. But, the whole election thing is a game.
Right.
And we should stop allowing us to be gamed by these unqualified people.
Amen, man. It is a revolving door. And we should have taken the Icelandic example with our bankers. But, live and learn.
Well, we still can. We still can.
That's true.
Let's elect some congressmen and senators who are decent human beings again. I've met several senators, one from Alaska who ran for president about 10 years ago. And he described how it was in the 80s when he was in Congress or in the Senate. He said, Democrat, Republican, we weren't biting at each other's necks like they are today. We would find points of compromise.
Right.
That the nation was primary. Now that's not the case. It's the party über alles. That's, that comes dangerously close to an American fascism.
Right.
And I don't think that's what Americans are all about. We're a free people. And let's get that back.
Amen.
We can do it.
I hope so. I do love your optimism. It makes me feel far less cynical than I usually end a show with. So that's great. But man, William, I've learned a lot from you. I really appreciate your dedication to understanding these complex geopolitical situations and your commitment to educating people on what you uncover. Before we go, tell the listeners where they can get more Engdahl.
WilliamEngdahl.com. William, ENGDAHL.com is my website. And you can get most of my articles. You can subscribe to my free twice monthly newsletter. If you go onto the website, and you'll get certain sections of some of my books as previews and so. Naturally, I'm interested in selling books so that I can continue my research independently. The books are also mentioned on the website. You can click on them and order them through Amazon.com. That also helps me to pay my bills. And there's a donate button up on the top of the website. But all of my articles are there for free. So if you appreciate what you get for free, I urge you to think about making the contribution. $10, $20, $50. Someone recently sent me $100 and he was very happy to read what I connected some dots in his life. But it doesn't matter. Whatever you feel in your heart to do, that's how I come further.
Right.
So WilliamEngdahl.com, it's all there. Everything I write in the English language, it's also there in German. If you read German or in Russian, some of my articles are there. In French, a few of them are there. It's you know, these are volunteers who've come to me and said, what you say is important. Can I translate that into French or Russian or whatever? So it's growing right now. I have to do everything more or less myself, but it's work I do with the passion and love. Mm-hmm. It puts light in dark corners and gives people what they normally, I hope, but I know it's the case, normally would not know. And The Lost Hegemon, I urge anybody who's listened to this broadcast to click on the book. If you go into my website and subscribe to this free twice monthly newsletter, you will get a chapter of The Lost Hegemon so you can judge for yourself. Mm. But it's so important to understand what's going on in the world today with the U.S., with the Middle East, with Orlando, Florida, with all these things. It's all smoke and mirrors, fakery being done to bring us into a state of fear and not a state of peace and love. And that's no mamby-pamby, airy-fairy stuff. That is absolutely what it's all about in the world today.
Amen. And yeah, if people are sick of the mainstream narratives, you got to stop giving them your attention, and everything runs on money. So put your attention and money into the alternatives, and they will rise to eventually drown out the mainstream. So again, The Lost Hegemon is the book. I urge everybody to pick it up. I learned a lot from it. If you have any confusion over the Muslim Brotherhood and the history of how the American Empire has used it, I've never found a clearer narrative that described that for me. So I loved it. And take care out there. All right, man.
Thank you, Greg. I enjoyed the talk.
Awesome. Me too. All right, guys, there we have it. F. William Ingdahl, definitely a smart guy who knows a lot about some really confusing parts of history. He knows a lot about a lot, really. I mean, Seeds of Destruction, you might remember James Corbett dropping that book on the oil tycoon control episode we did not too long ago. It's great, and I'm glad we could get into that a little bit, too, because the details of the GMO agenda don't really get talked about nearly enough. Everybody talks about the links between vaccines and autism, but I think people might be missing some real adverse effects from GMOs and Roundup that are happening right around us, and those links just aren't as frequently talked about, I don't think. But we also got into some timely stuff like the disastrous, as always, presidential candidates and the Brexit situation. I don't know if I trust the integrity of that vote, but it is an interesting blip on the world's radar nonetheless. It's just fun to hear about the idea that the oligarchs are scrambling to keep control as it starts to slip away. I mean, that was the main theme here, laying out the plan as the globalists wanted, and then breaking down how that agenda is fizzling out and that this is a time of change we haven't seen in decades. Change is scary, but we know the elite have had us in an anaconda's grip from cradle to grave for a long time. Maybe there's something better on the other side, right? It's a position that I appreciate, and I hope this is a time to be optimistic. So we had a solid first hour, rounding things out with the Jesuits making yet another appearance in THC Conversation, talking about the refugee crisis and what the Jesuit Pope calls the Great Migration. It is a strange time, and the refugee issue is a complex one. I've watched a few documentaries from inside these camps, and it is pretty terrible. The people think that it's only going to be a couple weeks, and then it's months, and now over a year, and can you imagine having to leave your home because it's now a battleground? Any money you brought with you is now gone because it's been 2 years. You really can't prepare enough. You can't work anywhere. You probably didn't even have time to learn the language, and you don't know where you're going. It just sucks, and we should have compassion for that. That is the great majority of people affected by this. They just want to go home. So we should go to the source of the problem, you know, the globalist superpowers that are using these people's homes as a battleground for a proxy war. If we just shut our borders, rather than pressuring our governments to leave them alone, we're pretty much just selfish assholes, right? We're saying, look, we don't care what happens to you, we don't care what anyone does to you, just don't come here, okay? I mean, that is the attitude that we put off, and I'm really uncomfortable when I hear some people talking about it in that regard, but I think William breaks it down pretty well. And then, of course, we have the Plus Show where we get into vaccines and Bill Gates' little project in Africa, also about how China has forged a productive relationship with parts of Africa, how GMOs are playing out in China, the content from William's book, Gods of Money, and what's going on in the world of banking consolidation, and other good stuff. You know the drill. Sign up for Plus to hear the second hour of every show. But I hope you liked this one. It is the last practical show on the roster this month. For the rest of the month, we're getting into some pretty weird areas and hitting on some pretty unique topics. So I'm excited. I hope you're excited. Pick up The Lost Hegemon if you want more details on the things we talked about today. And I'll see you soon. Your move, oligarchs of the hemorrhaging hegemon. Your fucking move.
Oh no, you see, the world isn't random, it's attached to puppet strings. Control over everything. The 9 to 5 is trying to steal ya. Now don't that job seem silly? Hello, can you hear me? Or should I play back recordings from some spy agency? Wish we were younger and free. I'll be thankful when it's all exposed, the vast conspiracy. There's such a difference between us and the damn world.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehiresidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the five shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provide it all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site. If you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices, I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon, but I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehiresidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehiresidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle, sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the five shows the previous month, and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?